We turn to 2 Kings and chapter 3. And we read of a king, Jehoram. Now Jehoram, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel in Samaria in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and reigned 12 years. And you may be familiar with the pattern as you go through that Kings and Chronicles, that each king is compared in the length of his reign with the king who's reigning at that time in the other part of Israel. So the northern kingdom, you will read that there was a king and he reigned and he came to reign in such and such a year of this king of Judah. Because you remember there were the two kingdoms, the kingdom in the north, the kingdom in the south, after the division, after Solomon's death, when Rehoboam became the king of Judah and Jeroboam became the king of Israel in the north. Last week we saw two significant things, two signs, you could say, in chapter 2. The purifying of the water supply in Jericho and the rather dramatic mockery of Elisha by local youths, which was punished by God by two she-bears attacking the young men. And we find Israel have another ungodly king on the throne. Ahab was that king who stands out. He and Elijah are the two principal characters in 1 Kings, the last chapters of 1 Kings and the first of 2 Kings. And Ahab had a number of sons, but one was Ahaziah, and he reigned for just a couple of years, and he died according to the word of the Lord which Elijah had spoken, we read. And Jehoram reigned in his stead in the second year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, because he had no son. Ahaziah, who had died, had no son, so his brother took over. You see, so Ahab's next two sons both became king. And the scene we're returning to today is of the northern kingdom, where Elijah and the wicked king Ahab, as I say, were the main standout characters until the year that Ahab died, which was 853 BC. Ahaziah reigned for 2 years, and then now Jehoram comes on the throne. And we can quickly sum up, and this is our first heading, shades of evil, shades of evil. We could quickly sum up, if we wanted to, the kings of the northern Israel, as we often do, the 10 tribes, all bad, ungodly leaders, and then proceed to look at the slightly more favourable picture in the south. But a closer look will reveal different shades of evil. Jeroboam was the first of the Israel kings, Israel on its own. He made Israel to sin. That's his epitaph. It comes up every now and then. This king was bad, but not as bad as Jeroboam, or even as Jeroboam, who made Israel to sin. Now, he was a man who was proud, very proud to be recalled from exile, determined to hang on to his kingdom. And he broke, without any conscience, it would seem, the second commandment by installing two golden calves in the kingdom, representing Jehovah. Ahab came to power 7 kings later, just 36 years for those 7 kings, and he wasn't content with breaking the second commandment, worshipping God in a wrong way, with graven images. He had to go straight at the throat of Israel's religious adherents, and he brought in Jezebel to be his wife and all her prophets of the hideous false god Baal. More of Ahab's character is revealed than the previous kings, despite a complete failure of his new fertility god. The first thing that happened was there was a famine and no rain, and Baal was meant to be the god of the rain, the god of the rivers, the god of the clouds. To provide water, he belligerently pursued Elijah, the one man who told him the truth, calling him, "Thou that troublest Israel." He also faced Elijah later in the vineyard of the man Naboth. He'd taken possession of the vineyard when Jezebel had Naboth killed, and identified Elijah, "Hast thou found me, O mine enemy?" Sad. Ahaziah was a man notable for his reckless mistakes. Even in the 2 years of his reign, he met rebellion from Moab. Now, the Moabites were distant relatives of Israel, because their father, going back centuries, was Lot, Abraham's nephew Lot. But they were inveterate enemies of Israel at this time. And so that rebellion added up to a tribute which was paid to Israel every year by Moab, going back to the days of Ahab's father Omri. Ahaziah's reaction to this rebellion was just to fall through the window upstairs in his house. And he sent messengers to Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron, to find out if he would recover. His reaction to Elijah's intervention and rebuke was to send repeated armies to try to kill Elijah, all of which failed. And Ahaziah almost himself, he died. He died as a judgment when Elijah said, "Thou shalt die." Now Jehoram is on the throne. And the year is 851 BC. And the first comment we find is that Jehoshaphat had been king of Judah in Jerusalem down south for 18 years. So it's about half the time that Israel had used up seven evil kings. And I mentioned that you can't just write them all off as saying they were all evil. There are different shades of evil. Here's the slight change. In verse 2, he wrought evil in the sight of the Lord, but not like his father and like his mother, that's Ahab and Jezebel, for he put away the image of Baal that his father had made. And it gives you a little bit of hope. You think, well, it sounds like we have a reformer on the throne in the northern kingdom. Yet, he only got rid of the image of Baal in the house of Baal. He didn't get rid of Baal. And he didn't abandon Baal altogether. In verse 13 of this chapter, when Elisha is consulted by him, Elisha tells him, "Get thee to the prophets of thy father and mother." So even though he got rid of that statue of Baal, as a sort of, I suppose, let's try to bring back a semblance of the old religion, Baal worship was still going on, and he himself seems to still have had affinity to Baal. I want you to imagine, we're all quite disturbed, I think, at the great inroads of Baal in our day in England. Islam is the growing religion. It's growing all the time. The growing number of Muslims in our land, some of them nice people that you meet, but that religion, well, the increase in the number of mosques, the terrorism we see in our towns from Islamic extremists, it's all very worrying, whether you're a Christian or even if you're not. But just imagine, it's not going to happen. But suppose Islam suddenly disappeared. A radical government, Trump-like, in its extremes, got rid of Islam from our country. You no longer had the presence of the Muslim religion. Would life be purer here? Would religion in England be any more faithful to God's word? Well, no, because the state religion is totally corrupt. Anything short of a mighty spiritual revival wouldn't actually change anything in our land. That's what we should be praying for. Nevertheless, here's the difference. Now, a nevertheless can be a cause for a sigh of relief. Nevertheless, it's not so bad as we thought. At least he got this right. But in this case, it's a nevertheless, don't get too excited. Because he cleaved unto the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. He departed not therefrom. I suppose if all the true religion of the living God you've ever known is a wicked compromise, you might expect God to be satisfied as long as you're not bowing down to Baal. Jehoram probably thought this was as close as you get to a return to worshipping the Lord. But he was clinging to the same golden calf religion that his father and mother had maintained. And Jeroboam, the first king of Israel, the divided off Israel, had instituted. He was clinging to that. But also, this is our second heading, he was losing influence and control in verses 4 and 5. And Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheep master, and rendered unto the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and 100,000 rams with the wool. But it came to pass when Ahab was dead that the king of Moab rebelled against Israel. Well, here was a situation where in relation to one of their neighbours, Israel went from a position of strength and authority to a place whose neighbours, Moab, were stronger and felt strong enough to rebel. This tribute, 100,000 rams and 100,000 lambs, was paid every year by the Moabites. I'm not in a position to say whether that was an extortionate amount, whether it was really great. Doesn't sound enormous, but 100,000 rams, 100,000 lambs, the Moabites paid every year, but they didn't feel they had to anymore. Why should we do that? Israel was getting weaker. Ahab, for all his wickedness, was quite a strong military leader. But after Ahaziah, whose response to the rebellion which began then of Moab, in his reign, he fell through the window. And now Jehoram, well, who'd ever heard of him? A second choice. And so this tribute was stopped. It went back to the days of Ahab's father Omri, who had defeated the Moabites and imposed this tribute upon them rather than wipe them out completely. You may be aware that in those days, political successes, military campaigns, were mostly recorded not on paper, but by carvings on stones or monuments. And you can find some examples of them in the British Museum. Well, the famous one is the Moabite Stone, and that's not in the British Museum, it's in the Louvre in Paris. And it records, from Misha's point of view, how Omri had conquered Moab in the days of Misha's father. Well, we've got it all here in the scriptures, but it's also there on the Moabite Stone, recorded by the enemy. According to Misha, under the pleasure of his god, Chemosh, he was enabled to throw off the tribute which Omri had imposed. So the scriptures are all backed up, if we needed it, by the Moabite Stone, which is in the Louvre in Paris, if you're passing. Now, Misha's rebellion began in the reign of Ahaziah. And now, when Jehoram came to the throne, Misha took his chance. He refused to send Jehoram his 100,000 lambs and 100,000 rams with the wool. Might be compared, I suppose, to the weakening of the church in our country, losing our grip. Thinking of the church with a small c. And how about 30 years ago, I suppose, rebellion set in against the Lord's Day. We were holding on, and every year the Lord's Day was preserved, and the shops didn't open on Sundays, and gambling was prohibited in any public way. Well, it all went in one year or two that those things were given, because the church was so weak. The message of the Christian protest was not heard. However, God was still being protective of Israel, and the comparative strength they still had, Jehoram prepared for the battle. In verse 6, he went out of Samaria at that time and numbered. And probably that means he mustered. He got all Israel together. But then we have an amazing picture of a repeated compromise. You know, they say that we're always likely to commit the same errors again. I know I'll make the same mistakes again, has been often said. And this is true of even the most godly people. Following through the successive kings of both Israel and Judah, you tend to feel a little relieved to come across one of the eight godly kings of Judah. And you read more about this man Jehoshaphat in Chronicles, because the books of Kings major on the northern kingdom and the books of Chronicles major on the southern kingdom. So you read more about Hezekiah and Josiah and Jehoshaphat in the books of Chronicles. But Jehoshaphat is brought into the story here. He made a significant error of judgment. Most of what we know of Jehoshaphat is there in 2 Chronicles 14 to 20. And he reigned for 35 years, including 3 years co-regent with his father Asa. That's in Judah, Jerusalem, and the small tribe of Benjamin, right down in the south. He was fully aware of the idolatry and the godlessness of the kings and peoples of Israel, yet It's an observation, not without good grounds, that even faithful believers are known to fall foul of the same sin repeatedly. There it is, a message for us. Let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. So often when we fall into sin, it's the same sin we committed before, and we fall foul to the same thing, whether it be pride, whether it be lust of some sort, whatever it might be. Christians fall into sin, and often we fall into the same sin. Oh, how we need to pray, how we need to guard, and when we have fallen, to come back to the Lord and ask the Lord to protect us against all sin, but particularly to prevent us when that particular sin takes place. I remember a godly pastor saying to me once that he was so grateful that often opportunity doesn't coincide with desire. That when you have a desire for something sinful, the Lord takes away the opportunity. And when you have the opportunity to sin, the Lord gives you strength against the desire. Pray that that might be the case. Well, here was a man, Jehoshaphat, who knew all about the idolatry, and he knew all about the mistakes. He was a godly king. He got rid of Baal worship completely, which had set in even in Judah. He took away the high places. You remember the high places were those elevated pieces of ground where idolaters felt they were nearer to heaven, and therefore that's where they conducted their sacrifices. And he got rid of all those, and on three occasions, having sent servants out to teach God's law in and around Jerusalem, but on three occasions he allied himself with Israel. And that was such a mistake. We know it's a mistake, sensibly, but also because he was severely rebuked after the first time by a prophet. Let me go through the details for you. We would suppose the motivation was the pact. There was a pact between Israel and Judah after there had been war between them. And that was good that they came to an arrangement. It wasn't God's will that Israel be fighting Judah. This was an agreement between Omri, Ahab's father, and Asa, who was Jehoshaphat's father. The first surprising alliance comes in 1 Kings 22. And you might remember we studied this fairly recently. Before we went into Thessalonians, we were looking at 1 Kings. And in 1 Kings 22, we covered a few months ago, Jehoshaphat was visiting Ahab. And Ahab asked him to join in the battle to regain Ramoth-Gilead from Ben-Hadad, king of Syria. Jehoshaphat was almost killed in the battle. Ahab was mortally wounded, and Jehoshaphat escaped, unharmed. But then the prophet Jehu came to visit him and rebuked him in 2 Chronicles 19, and he said, "Should you help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord, therefore his wrath upon thee from the Lord." And so he suffered the wrath of the Lord, not any great punishment, but just knowing that God was angry with him. Well, wouldn't you learn that lesson? If the prophet of God came to you and told you that God was angry, he should have learned, but probably he valued peace with Israel rather than war, quite understandably, and he fell into the same trap when he joined Ahab's eldest son, Ahaziah, in a shipbuilding project at Ezion, and that's recorded in Chronicles. Ezion-Geber on the Gulf of Arafat. Every ship was destroyed before its maiden voyage. Eleazar, the son of Dodavar, was the prophet who God sent to rebuke Jehoshaphat for the second error of judgment, which is so similar to the first. "Because thou hast joined with Ahaziah, the Lord hath broken thy works." Think of that. The work, all the things which you try to do for the Lord being broken because you've allied yourself with those that do evil. And make no mistake, you can't say that he was a good man gone wrong. Ahab and his two sons were evil men. To ally yourself with them, even in a venture which seemed to be for the good of both, was not a very wise thing to do. Jehoshaphat indeed made the same mistake again. All the good influence he had, the evangelistic work, the pastoral ministry he conducted, compromised with evil kings. Jehoram, in our chapter, soiled his good work The Bible paints the characters God chooses to use, warts and all. On both the first and third of these occasions, Jehoshaphat agrees to the proposal of unity with warm, wholehearted, entirely out of place enthusiasm. Verse 7, he said, "I will go up, I am as thou art, my people as thy people, and my horses as thy horses." You can hardly believe it, after the two previous occasions when God rebuked him for allying himself with the king of Israel. You know, some visitors to our fellowship, I think we're all here today quite aware of the reasons why we don't unite with all the other churches in Medway, but some visitors to our fellowship may ask, why don't you join forces with the churches together in the Medway towns in evangelistic work? Why, the people look and they can see just a small number here this morning, sometimes a few more, sometimes less, who gather. Why don't you meet with all the other churches and have a joint evangelistic effort? And our answer is the response God sent to Jehoshaphat through Jehu and again through Eliezer. Should we help the ungodly? Oh, but they're churches. But they preach a false gospel. If they preach at all, they probably try to act it or use puppets. Should we help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? And because thou hast joined with Ahaziah or local unbelieving churches, the Lord hath broken thy works. Any good we're doing, any work, any thing that we may not even see is happening through our leaflets going out, why, it would be ruined if we were joining with those that love not the Lord. But you know, that's not our primary application. It's easy for us to sit here and say we're not uniting with other churches, but it's our hearts, it's our souls. Are your works, your witness, your testimony at home, at work, in your neighbourhood, are your testimony, is it being spoiled? Is it being broken like Jehoshaphat's ships because you compromise with the world in any way? If we as a church or individually are compromising with the world and living worldly lives, we can't expect the Lord to bless our spiritual lives. What was the outcome? Well, this is an interesting passage, and we must do it fairly quickly because we were coming drawing to a close. But they, verse 8, they went through the wilderness of Edom. Presumably that was the most sensible effort, the way to go. But verse 9, God is in control. 7 days, and three kings, Israel, Judah, and Edom, they've crept in there somewhere. Three armies, but no water for men or beast. Verse 10, the king of Israel thinks of God, but not for guidance, only as judge. The Lord is calling us three kings together to deliver us into Moab's hands. The only time he mentions Jehovah is in hopeless surrender. God is judging us. Verse 11, Jehoshaphat, the man of God amongst them. Isn't there a prophet of the Lord we can consult? Exactly what he'd asked Ahab in the first battle of Alliance. And one of the king's servants is the only one. The king of Israel doesn't think of it, but one of the king's servants recalls Elisha lives nearby. And Jehoshaphat sees hope, verse 12. The word of the Lord is with him. In verse 13, Elisha says, well, I've got no regard for Jehoram. And he addresses Jehoram, what have I to do with thee? Get thee to the prophets of thy father and thy mother, the prophets of Baal. Exactly what Jehoshaphat should have said. I have nothing to do with you. Jehoram repeats his sad conclusion. The Lord hath called us together to deliver us to Moab. And God is sovereign. Verse 14, Elisha firmly explains, it's only because of Jehoshaphat that I'm listening to you at all. I wouldn't look upon you for all his repeated compromise. He's the only believer. And Elisha recognizes that. Bring a minstrel. Why did he want a minstrel? A harpist to play psalms, because they wanted an atmosphere of godliness. We seek the Lord's help humbly in acts of worship and praise. Verses 16 and 17, the instruction, make this valley full of ditches. You've got work to do. If you want to see revival, you've got work to do. Thus saith the Lord, you won't see rain or wind, yet the valley shall be full of water. Verses 18 and 19, be ruthless with Moab. You must destroy the land. God will deliver Moab into your hands. So we have some lessons for revival. Be prepared to dig. You know, the years go by and churches sometimes meet together for revival prayer meetings. We used to have them, some of the churches, evangelical churches in the Medway towns, three or four good sound churches. And we used to meet for revival prayer meetings. But the thought was put forward, well, what are we doing about it? It's all very well praying for revival, but are we evangelizing? Are we preaching the gospel? Are we going out with leaflets? Are we knocking on doors? How's our Sunday school getting on? What are we doing? We can't expect the Lord to bless without any effort from us. Although we know that our efforts can't produce anything, we could leaflet every house, knock on every door, we could plead with every person, but not one person would be saved unless God is at work. But we've got to dig. Be prepared to dig in your personal life. How will you become the Christian that you know you should be? Well, be prepared to dig. Dig into God's word. Dig into your very soul in prayer. Spend time seeking the Lord. Oh, friends, the older I get, the more I realize how much time has been wasted. How we need to put the Lord first. Revival is clearly and obviously God's work. You can dig till you dug the whole valley. Only God can give the water of life. And then the delusion of Moab, verses 21 to 23. And when all the Moabites, they heard the kings were come up to fight against them, they gathered all that were able to put on armor, and they stood in the border, ready to resist. They rose up early in the morning, the sun shone on the water, the Moabites saw the water on the other side as red as blood. And they said, this is blood, the kings are surely slain, they've smitten one another. Now therefore, Moab to the spoil. When they came to the camp of Israel, the Israelites rose up and smote them, but they fled before them. They went forward, smiting the Moabites, even in their country. And the story goes on, and the king of Moab eventually, even in a very evil way, took his eldest son and gave him as a burnt offering. And that's what people are doing all around us, sacrificing their children with their sins and with the allowing them to take up the language, the gutter language that they've used. People are sacrificing their children still today. The delusion of Moab, the sight of blood, victory over Moab. It was a horrible end, but it still happens. We learn from these three kings. Jehoram, hardness of heart, half-hearted reform, doesn't impress the Lord. Yet there was some blessing before finally being condemned. Edom, where did they come from? They were lifelong enemies of God. And they seem happy to join forces with this united effort. Jehoshaphat, oh, be careful what alliances we make in our church and in our personal lives. Stand not with the fornicators. Stand not with those that deceive. Stand not with those that are leading our children astray. Stand apart. Touch not the unclean thing, and I will be a God unto you, says the Lord. And that is our message for today. And we come to the Lord's table together now.